Hello, you're listening to Playback Daily on Tuesday, the 6th of May. I'm Louise Herity, and here's just some of what's coming up.
And what I remembered was just that all I could feel was the heat, this intense heat in pitch black. And at this time when I needed to feel something else, I just thought that's what I need, to go somewhere where for a few hours I can not have to think.
We have two films there that we're hoping will sell. I mean, in fact, as it's turned out, they both sold to America, but there'll be lots of other people trying to sell films to America. And the uncertainty that this engenders is not good for business.
So often people will hear our name before ever meeting with us, and they'll bring all their own kind of associations, and whether they're subconscious or conscious, to that.
The White House has said that no final decision has yet been made about imposing tariffs on films made abroad. Donald Trump has threatened to impose a 100% tariff on films produced elsewhere and being distributed in the US in a bid to make Hollywood great again, he says. Ed Guiney is the co-CEO of Ireland's most successful film company, Element Pictures, and he joined Audrey Carvel on Morning Ireland to discuss the news.
Ed, you're very welcome indeed. It's all very vague at this stage. Would you have any idea how a tariff on films that Element makes here would work?
Honestly, I don't. I mean, we're all scratching our heads. I mean, it was very disconcerting to wake up to that bombshell yesterday morning. And actually, I suppose since then, as with often as is often the case with Trump, you know, things aren't, you know, have moderated and changed, and now the White House are making more kind of you know, I won't say positive, but they're kind of qualifying the statement, I suppose. But it's really hard to understand how a tariff would be imposed, because so much of the activity that happens in the world is actually owned by American studios. These things are services. They're not products in the way that, you know, you traditionally imagine a tariff being imposed on a product. So an awful lot of head scratching. I think behind it, there is definitely an anxiety in the States, in that there is a lot of what they call runaway production. In other words, American film and television production that shoots all around the world. And actually, we benefit from it hugely here in Ireland. I mean, as is well known, we have an amazing crew base here, and we've very decent incentives and a very buoyant industry. Same with the UK and Canada. But so I think there is a feeling that, you know, that a lot of American stuff should be shooting in the US, but actually that's largely down to the cost base in the States, which is very high, and also the incentives. And there are incentives in some of the states of America, but they're not necessarily as they don't kind of even the playing field, you know, with kind of international production. So I think the other thing that's emerged from this is a conversation around whether there should be a federal tax incentive in America to keep American production at home.
The films that you make here, Ed, I mean, would many of them be funded with US money?
Yes, they would. Yeah, very often. Now, we work a lot. We've just made a film in the UK and in America, in fact, called Begonia, Yorgos Lanthimos' new film, which is fully financed by Universal, by Focus. And we frequently work with the studios. And actually, if there was some, you know, kind of way of imposing this tariff logically, it would be very, very damaging for all of us here in Ireland, and indeed all international, you know, all international destinations for film production would be under severe threat. Yeah. But I think everyone feels it's just quite hard to imagine how it will be imposed.
Well, I just can't get my head around that. If much of your work and others' work is funded from the United States, at what point would a tariff apply, and who would pay it?
Well, exactly. I mean, I don't think anyone has an answer to that question at all. Because as you say, rightly, you know, say for instance, Netflix commissions a show and it's on, it's shot, say, here in Ireland, like take Bodkin, and it's available on all their platforms internationally as well as America. How do you put the tariff on the American bit of that? How does that even begin to be possible? And the other thing I should say, actually, in reference to Bodkin, is that he's only talked about films so far, not television. So to say, for instance, Bodkin wouldn't actually be touched under, you know, the current thinking. But no, it's very confusing. I mean, the other thing to say about America is, about the American film industry, it is, I think, it has a net positive trade balance with every single country in the world. I think it's the only American industry that does. And the top 10 films internationally last year were all American films. So The American film industry is actually in very good health. It's in rude, rude health. I think the issue is that a lot of these productions are being shot internationally.
So you've everything crossed that this just goes away.
Yeah, I mean, the other theory actually at the moment is that because he's meeting Mark Carney this week and the film shooting a film in Canada is such a massive, you know, part of the Canadian economy that it's a kind of a shot across Carney's bows. I don't know if that's true, but it's another thing that people are saying about it. But yeah, I mean, the thing that's, you know, very disconcerting, I will say, is the uncertainty, as is always the case. And we're about to go into the Cannes Film Festival. We have two films there that we're hoping will sell. I mean, in fact, as it's turned out, they both sold to America, but there'll be lots of other people trying to sell films to America. And the uncertainty that this engenders is not good for business. It really isn't. And that's coming on the back of COVID, the SAG strikes, the fires in LA.
Of course.
You know, kind of a tough old time for the industry. Yeah. So it just isn't helpful.
Ed Guiney, co-CEO of Element Pictures, chatting to Audrey Carvel on Morning Ireland. On Today with Claire Byrne, the host was joined by Gráinne Humphreys, director of the Dublin International Film Festival, to talk about the best Jane Austen adaptations. But first, Gráinne gave her take on Donald Trump's plans for tariffs on foreign films.
Listen, before we talk about Jane Austen, though, this morning we started the programme talking about Donald Trump's plans for tariffs on foreign films coming into the United States. Now, the experts we spoke to said, look, this seems half-baked, but it will have an impact on investment and it's happening at a very important time coming up to Cannes. Do you agree with that assessment that it will shake things?
I think it will shake things. I think it'll achieve what he always wants to achieve, which is to be the centre of attention. And I think Cannes, which I've been to for many years and love, I always thought was a bit like a bell jar, you know, that you basically blocked out the external world for the best part of 2 weeks. That's not going to happen. This is going to be the sole topic of conversation, maybe just the way he wants it. Also, I mean, I have a conspiracy theory that Mission Impossible, the final installment, is going to launch there. And I'm sure Trump maybe is aware of this information and going, why isn't this happening on US soil? You know, that there's a sense of the launch of this franchise. The idea that, you know, there are wonderful links between American and world cinema. And again, I just feel sorry for the American audiences. They're going to get stuck just watching potentially American films, you know, until this particular situation gets, you know, resolved. Because to be honest, the most exciting cinema is coming from around the world. And you have to see it in that kind of combination and in that kind of way in order to kind of see the references. And also, some of the best American films have been made, you know, by non-American directors and shot and with non-American casts. So it feels somewhat like a known goal.
That's the problem that he has with it, though, isn't it? That
it
the
is.
Production isn't happening on American soil.
Fingers crossed he'll wake up tomorrow and forget about it.
Well, we'll have to wait and see. Anyway, let's put ourselves into the bell jar of Jane Austen now. Remind us a little bit, tell us a little bit about her, who she is, her background and so on.
She's kind of fascinating because I was looking again at the weekend and in a way it feels like she's writing from life. So she grew up the father of, or the daughter of a school teacher, a rector. She had five siblings, all brothers and one sister, and lived at home for you know, a very long time, didn't have a huge amount of formal schooling because she got typhus and ended up going home. And then her father died. And then there was a whole kind of, as is, you know, perfect at the time she was born in 1778, you know, a pressure on the family as to what they were going to do. People needed to marry well. She did fall in love. I think she was in her late teens and she fell in love with a guy, but neither she had money or he had money. And they were told to basically forget about it. And that was the love of her life. She had one more proposal later on and she accepted. And then the next day realized that after a day of engagement, she didn't love him and went and broke it off. And then unfortunately, she published four novels in her lifetime, but all of them were kind of modest successes and published anonymously. Mm-hmm. And then she died at 41. It was really, I suppose, the books that kind of took off. Do you know what I mean? She only published six with a couple of other kind of writings around it. But what I think is fascinating is that, if you like, biography feels like many of the different pieces to the kind of key novels, you know?
Yeah, and she did use her life experience. I mean,
absolutely.
You mentioned that she didn't have any money, which is why she couldn't marry the love of her life. But she did sort of mix in those society groups,
she did,
didn't she?
She did. She herself and her sister Cassandra went to a number of balls, and there was a lot of kind of observation. I mean, apparently her sister actually destroyed a number of her letters because they were quite kind of catty and mean about family and friends, and there was a kind of protection going on. But she was very aware of that lifestyle, mm-hmm. and of the kind of social etiquette and of the kind of negotiating that would go on at those kind of social events. And again, the outsider may be due to her sort of social position, but also always having this keen awareness of kind of the importance of money and what it could do. And indeed negotiated with her publisher that she would have to, you know, apparently self-publish or, you know, fund her own publishing. So she was clever and kind of smart about the role of money and what it could bring. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, as I said, very, very observant about characters. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, as we're talking, we'll go through, that's what connects with audiences down the years.
Yeah, even now, 200 years later, absolutely. We still have filmmakers, we still have audiences who, you know, are hungry to revisit those stories, which are observations about human relationships, essentially.
They are. I think they're also, I mean, as a woman, you read them and you think, oh, yes, I can see where this is, you know, this is coming from and going to. There are a lot of them are genuinely about one single thing, which is the dependence of women on marriage as a way of being economically stable or socially acceptable, and how your families can feed into that or draw away from it. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, there's a great line, I think, in, is it Vanity Fair, which is someone else's writing, but it's she's not a social climber, she's a mountaineer. And indeed, that's the kind of tension that you have about, you know, how do you get ahead? Do you find the right appropriate husband and make the right match? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, in a way, the relevance is that still feels something that people aspire to, is to try and find the right match and the one that kind of works for your own maybe life goals.
So we have this remake, new one coming up from Netflix. Yes. There's a lot of buzz around this.
Because it's got a really good kind of look to it. I mean, I kind of feel like there's a Pride and Prejudice every generation, you know, that everybody kind of like needs a Pride and Prejudice that reflects the kind of morals or the kind of issues or focuses. So this is Emma Corrin, who is kind of fantastic. I think she's wonderful. She was brilliant in The Crown, Lady Chatterley's Lover. She's really interesting, but also brings a kind of slightly kind of distance, a kind of a sort of slightly abstract kind of quality to her acting. And then you have the wonderful Jack Loudon, who I love from Slow Horses. I think he's brilliant. And I think he may, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but he'll bring maybe a slightly more warmth to Mr. Darcy. Mm-hmm. And then the Olivia Colman from Everything, who was wonderful in Everything.
I mean, you couldn't cast anybody else right now in that role of Mrs. Bennet, could
no,
you?
No, I mean, Olivia's. I think it doesn't feel though that role is the one that kind of dates it. I mean, you know, as we go through the kind of classic ones, you know, the Elizabeth Bennet is often, you know, incredibly beautiful and brings a kind of stature to it. But it's also her mother, also was played usually by a kind of key character actress at a particular time of her career. And that's what really, that's the time stamp, mm-hmm. if you like, on an Austen. You know, I think maybe, I don't know, do you want to talk about the classics?
I do. Genre? And I want to talk, just wondering, as you're saying that, you know, that each generation gets a Pride and Prejudice. Will this one be judged against the one that people love?
Absolutely.
The 1995 BBC TV series.
Absolutely. I mean, I'd go back slightly and go, there's a 1940 one with Greer Garson and Laurence Olivier. And if there was someone to be imperious and obnoxious with a great voice, it's Laurence Olivier. But 1995, which hilariously is the same year that Clueless and Sense and Sensibility came out in, which is bizarre. It feels mm-hmm. like that was the Jane Austen year. But this was special. I mean, it had Jennifer Ely and Colin Firth playing Elizabeth Bennet and Mrs. Darcy. And then, you know, Alison Steadman, talking about Mrs. Bennet, Alison Steadman, most famous probably for Beverly in Abigail's Party, who has this incredible screech that she uses as Elizabeth Bennet's mother, the mother trying desperately to get her daughters out and married well. It's a beautiful, beautiful adaptation. It's a 6-part series, BBC. It was must-see destination television. I mean, if you weren't there, what were you doing, right? Yeah. And then we have to famously talk about a certain scene where Colin Firth ends up in a lake that I think, you know, was the screenshot. It was like the Daniel Craig shot from Casino Royale. Everybody had it. Everybody talked about it. And I think what's wonderful about it is Andrew Davis was a brilliant playwright and adapted House of Cards for television. But with this, he really, I think, took something that, again, was a well-known, very well-known, much-loved novel, but turned it into something that then set sail.
Let's take a listen now. Yes. This is from the 1995 BBC adaptation of Pride and Prejudice.
You're too generous to trifle with me. If your feelings are what they were last April, tell me so at once. My affections and wishes are unchanged. But one word from you will silence me on this subject forever.
Oh, my feelings. My feelings are ashamed to remember what I said then. My feelings are so different. In fact, they are quite the opposite.
I think a rewatch is on the cards for you. Kind of whets the appetite. Let's go back and watch it.
It does. But isn't it? It's like this dent. I mean, it's funny mentioning about House of Cards, but Andrew Davis captured that kind of nearly parliamentary aspect to these ballrooms and these sitting rooms, mm-hmm. and how it's all these kind of clipped, you know, regulated engagement with etiquette and rules and
exactly.
formality. Mm-hmm. And then you have these incredible, nearly explosive sequences between the lovers where everything is terribly sharp and terse and emotion. And I can remember, you know, some of the films that we're talking about, there's always a moment where the heroine suddenly realizes what she should do and who she should be talking to or in love with. And suddenly you can see the entire audience, their hearts just explode out of them. And it's kind of this amazing, it's very, very realized to that kind of melodramas from the 1950s, you know, the Douglas Sirk films where people just, as I said, are so repressed for 85 minutes mm-hmm. and those last 5 minutes leave you in tears.
Well, let's stay with 1995
yes.
now, and I have a clip here from another popular adaptation, the Oscar-winning Sense and Sensibility.
I have described Mr. Willoughby as the worst of libertines. But I have since learnt from Lady Allen that he did mean to propose that day, and therefore I cannot deny that his intentions towards Marianne were honourable. I feel certain that he would have married her had it not been
for the money. Dearest, was I right to tell you?
Of course.
Whatever his past actions, whatever his present course, at least you may be certain that he loved you.
But not enough. Not enough.
Is anyone else thinking about Harry Potter? I can't help it. It's Alan Rickman.
It's Alan Rickman, Emma Thompson, Hugh Grant and Kate Winslet. I mean, that's the other side to these, is they're so appealing to actors and the casts are so fantastic. They're also, not in that clip, they're really funny. There's wonderful kind of irony and satire, and there's particularly in this film, it's incredibly funny. I mean, Emma Thompson, who won an Oscar for writing the screenplay, and again, I'm sure purists are probably annoyed because there's very little, I suppose, of the novel in this, but it's wonderfully drawn. The characters, as I said, the sequences that scene there, they're brilliantly drawn and they're incredibly emotional. And again, mm-hmm. I kind of feel like that's part of it. You get these casts really going to another level.
Well, there's so many ways to approach this. And you mentioned Clueless.
Yes.
Which is a modern take on Emma. Let's have a quick listen to a clip from Clueless.
The man is ridiculous. He doesn't have one unique thought in his little puny brain.
I think that there's some merit in learning form straight off.
Oh, Josh, please. He's taken our minds at the most fecund point and restrained them before they've wandered through the garden of ideas. It's just like Hamlet said, to thine own self be true.
Hamlet didn't say that.
I think that I remember Hamlet accurately.
Well, I remember Mel Gibson accurately. He didn't say that. That Polonius guy did.
So we take Emma and we set it in Beverly Hills.
We set it in Beverly Hills. And I mean, the thing about Clueless is that it's so rewatchable. I mean, it literally, the colour, the vibrancy, the energy. And it was coming off a straightforward Emma, which was the one with Gwyneth Paltrow, which was 1995. So it feels like there's this wonderful kind of like era of Jane Austen in the kind of mid-90s when people were kind of drilling in and wondering what they could do with it. The other side to it is that I just feel like, you know, a lot of actors, that's their best performance, that you actually find yourself going back and going, oh, you know, I could think about them and other things. But seeing them again, going through this transition. And also, it feels nearly theatrical. Mm-hmm. You know, they're playing with a stage like sort of like aspect to it. But again, for audiences, I think half of the joy is to kind of spot who is playing which character. You know, like Shakespeare, it's the adaptation foregrounded.
At the end of all that, Grainne, I think we need to go back to 1995 to the BBC, Pride and Prejudice, watch it again before the new one comes out, you know?
Absolutely, to compare and contrast.
That was Grainne Humphreys, director of the Dublin International Film Festival, on Today with Claire Byrne. From movies to books, author Florence Knapp was Oliver Callan's guest today. Her debut novel, The Names, is tipped to be a book club and holiday read favourite. And she told Oliver how she's coping with all the hype around her book.
It does feel very surreal, but really wonderful as well. I've written a previous novel that didn't find a home. Mm-hmm. And so I think all I wanted for this one was for it to exist in the world as a real tangible thing. But it's been lovely to have had such a kind of fantastic early response to it from certainly within the publishing industry.
Yeah, there were a 13-way bidding war. Can you explain to people not in the books industry what that essentially means?
I didn't know what any of this meant before I went into it either. But I just wanted one publisher to want my novel. It was kind of just wonderful to have more than that wanting it. But it's essentially that your agent takes out your novel to different publishers, and then they kind of say whether they're interested and enter an auction if more than one are interested. And during the auction process, we went round and met with each of the publishers who was interested. That felt like a kind of week in my life that was so surreal and so far from, my own life really, because it's, as a writer, I've kind of naturally drawn towards a quite quiet life. It felt very other.
13 different companies fought it out, and this one obviously won it out. Your previous books that were published, can you tell people what they were about?
Yeah, so I have published a non-fiction book about English paper piecing, which is a really traditional method of hand sewing, mm-hmm. Where it sounds extraordinary, but you wrap bits of fabric around shapes like hexagons and then use that as a structure to sew them together and then take the paper out afterwards. Sorry, that's probably way too much detail.
No, I love the fact that you're writing about quilting and sewing, these lovely English crafts, and then you've come out with this sensational novel that everyone is talking about. It's a nice story for yourself.
Well, I think my book, the second half of it focused on the techniques around that craft, but the first half of it was more focused on the psychology of why we work with our hands and what it means to us to do that, and why it kind of, you know, the benefits to us as people. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways it feels like it taps into my novel, because there are so many makers and artisans who kind of pop up as characters throughout the names.
It's a huge part of it, and particularly the Irish part of it, which we're delighted to talk about.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, yes.
Because you're new to the scene, this novel world, everyone's going to get to know the name Florence Knapp. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? You're from England?
Yes, I'm from England, although when I was six, I moved to Australia for a couple of years because of my father's work. But I have spent the rest of my life in England, and I live just outside London with my husband and have two grown-up children. Who are kind of my daughter's home for a little bit for a moment, so we're enjoying having her back. But yeah, no, they're off out in the world doing their own thing now.
And like a lot of people nowadays in the public eye, you've decided to keep your children's names private, which is, I think, significant considering it's a novel about names.
Sorry, the line's gone a bit.
Oh, sorry, apologies. I was talking about the names.
You're back again.
You've decided to keep your own grown-up children's names private as you go into the limelight. And I think that's curious, given that you've written a novel about names.
Yeah, I think it feels very much like your name is very much the, you know, it's this collection of vowels and consonants that you very much live within, and it's hard to tell where one thing ends and the other begins. And I guess that I wanted to leave my children's names to just be defined by them and the things they want to do in the world, rather than kind of my book. And I mean, they're very happy to be named and kind of would have embraced that. But I think I feel as their parent that I really want their names to be just things that they exist in themselves, where they kind of form the story that's, you know, their name.
I think it's a nice idea. Were you named after Florence Nightingale?
No, it was funny, actually. My mum always used to say to me, you weren't named after Florence Nightingale. Apparently she wasn't actually very nice at times. So no, I was named after, there was a French stop motion animation called The Magic Roundabout in the 1970s, when my mum was pregnant. Yeah. And I was named after a character called Florence in there just because my mum loved her shoes. She had these enormous white shoes that were lace-ups, and my mum thought they were so quaint and sweet and part of the whole French appeal of the programme, and so I was called Florence after her.
That's as good a reason as any. Is your name shortened sometimes?
No, it's funny. I think we're all so different in that way, aren't we? But it's to me, when someone shortens my name, it feels slightly like they've kind of reached across and adjusted my hair or kind of removed my scarf or something. And I'm left thinking, God, I wanted those letters. Give them back.
Yeah.
Because it's I feel very much like I feel like a Florence. And so when someone says Flo, I like the name, but I don't recognise myself in it.
I see. They've kind of given you a completely different name, even though it's
part of it. Yes. Yeah, it's a bit like if they'd call me Brian, it feels that kind of level of kind of, oh, that's not actually my name.
So here you are anyway with the names. Will you tell us what it's all about? Because I'm afraid to give things away because things happen so quickly early on. It's hard to know what I can give away. So you will be the arbiter of that.
Okay. So it's a sliding doors what if style novel that looks at how the name we're given can shape the course of a person's life. And it spans 35 years, and it opens in the wake of the 1987 storm, which I don't know whether that hit Ireland in the same way that it hit the UK, but it was our biggest storm for over 200 years and came almost completely without warning. So when Cora sets out to name her child the morning after this storm, the world's already in complete disarray. Her husband is expecting her to name their child after him, because that's kind of a long-standing family tradition for him. And he's a very well-respected doctor in the local community, but just a really awful, fearful presence at home.
Yeah.
And as she's getting closer and closer to the registrar's office, she's kind of questioning whether it's actually, you know, whether it can be right to impose that legacy onto this kind of gorgeous newborn. And the narrative then splits off into three, depending on the name she does give to him. In one version of their lives, he is Bear, which is the name his elder sister has suggested for him, because she thinks that a boy with that name would be really soft and kind, but also brave and strong. In another version, he's Julian, which is the name his mother set her heart on. It means Sky Father, and she's feeling like she could say it was a tribute to her husband because it's about fathers, but she's also secretly thinking that she kind of hopes he'll be able to rise above this line of awful earth fathers. And then in another version of the story, he's Gordon and named after his father, and really, yeah, just a really troubled figure who's raised in his mold and is kind of quite manipulated by the father. And it follows each version of their lives across 35 years. And I think concentrates really on how a single decision like naming a child can lead to so many different possibilities.
It feels like you really do believe that if you switch name, or the name really does determine quite a lot, but then some of it actually not really.
Yeah, because I think we're all... you know, I'm sure your listeners, for some of them, would feel that their names had very little impact on them, whereas others may be feeling, oh, this really resonates and I know the name, the impact that my name's had on me. But I think one of the interesting things is that actually often we'll never know the impact our names actually had, because so often people will hear our name before ever meeting with us and they'll bring all their own kind of associations, and whether they're subconscious or conscious, to that. And, you know, that might affect whether we're invited in for a certain job interview or whether we cross paths with a potential partner. And so it has all these different ways of affecting us that we might not even be aware of. But then there are also those conscious ways, which I'm also really interested in.
The 7-year leap, is that to do with that belief that it takes our cells regenerate every 7 years that we essentially become?
Yeah, it's exactly that. I don't know how much basis in scientific fact there is for that, but it feels like such a widely held belief that it feels like a really nice place to explore their lives from.
I think I remember looking it up now. It was a couple of months since I read your novel, but I remember looking at the time as to where it takes 7 years for your cell to regenerate. And then in theory, your whole body has different cells from 7 years ago, which is kind of a scary thought, as if you've got a completely different physical makeup. But it was a fascinating way to do. And it's a nice way to move things from 1987 to 2022. It keeps the narrative really hopping along, because you're trying to figure out what's occurred in the 7 years since we last visited. And I think that was kind of, I presume, part of the idea from your point.
Sorry,
of view.
I'm struggling with the line a little bit too.
Oh, apologies for that.
Completely clearly what you said. Oh, that's much better. Thank you.
Apologies for that. I was just talking about the 7 year thing. But look, we'll cut straight to it if you can hear me, because I think the through line in the story is that of domestic violence and the emotional abuse and everything else associated with that in the home. Mm. And it's quite difficult. It's incredibly tense scenes at times during this story.
Mm-hmm. I think what drew me, well, it was odd, because when I set out to write this novel about names, I was actually wanting to write a novel just purely about upbringing and the way it affects us. But about 6 months before I'd started writing, someone from who ran a women's refuge and domestic abuse charity had visited a group of women that I was part of, and she talked to us a lot about her work. And the things she told us were so harrowing. It was during the pandemic, and as she was talking, I really struggled not to close the lid of my laptop, because it was so difficult to hear. But I think I tend to process the world either through writing or through reading. And so then those things that I'd heard, I guess, filtered into this story and became something that was a very much a part of it. But I guess because I was thinking, you know, well, I had a lot of basic questions left over that were floating around my mind of, well, what would make someone do that? And why doesn't someone leave? And what's the impact on the children who have that as part of, you know, who grow up in that environment? And so the novel gave me an opportunity to walk alongside Cora and her children and really think about the reasons for that, some of those things.
Author Florence Knapp chatting to Oliver Callan this morning, and her much anticipated debut novel is called The Names. Another female author was a guest on Sunday with Miriam at the weekend. Anne Tiernan has just published her second novel, The Good Mistress. She was born in Zambia, grew up in Navan, and now lives in New Zealand. And her brother is the one and only Tommy Tiernan.
Good morning, Miriam.
So lovely you're here. And you're here with your sister, Niamh, as well. She came with you today, all the Tiernans.
Niamh is outside looking at me, probably laughing at everything I say. So, yeah.
So look, tell me first about this trip home. Did you get a good chance to catch up with all your family and friends? I suppose as well as doing the promotional work for the book.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. So a little bit of play, a little bit of work. So really nice combination. But yeah, got to see everybody, hang out with some old friends and family, and got to see Tommy in Galway. Yeah. So yeah, it's been really lovely. It's been full on, but lovely.
What do you miss about Ireland? And do you miss Ireland?
I do. And I miss it every day. I've been in New Zealand now for 20 years. And I would say that it's actually getting harder to be away. And I don't know, is that a function of my age? You know, I'm getting older. Everybody I love is getting older. So yeah, I miss it every day. I miss so much about it. I mean, primarily the people, my family, but I just miss, I don't know, there's just, I miss the buildings. When I'm in Dublin, I love walking around the streets, but New Zealand is fabulous and it's a brilliant place to bring up kids, but it's just so far away. Like, you literally couldn't get further.
Now, how did you end up in New Zealand?
Love, I suppose. So I was working in ACC Bank in Dublin, and I started dating this Kiwi guy. And a few weeks after we'd started going out, he said, yeah, my visa's about to expire, so I'm going to head back to New Zealand. Do you want to come? And I had just bought a little flat in Chapelizod, bought myself a little car. And I was 30 and I thought, this is it. This is my life. I'm never going to leave Dublin. I loved it. But I thought, I'll go, you know, just do a bit of travelling, because we did 6 months of travelling. And then, you know, I'll spend a few months in New Zealand. And a few weeks into my 1 year working visa, I discovered I was pregnant. And it just, I think we were so shocked that there was no room in my head to make other decisions. So it was just, let's just stay. And now suddenly that was 20 years ago, and, you know, got the 19-year-old daughter and two other kids. So.
And are your three children full-blown Kiwis, or are they conscious of their Irishness, and who do they support when Ireland's playing the All Blacks?
I'm afraid to say they will always support the All Blacks. If Ireland are playing anybody else, then they'll support Ireland. But yeah, they're full-blown Kiwis, but they are very conscious of Ireland, and they love it here. We brought them back at the end of last year for Christmas, and we did a big trip with them. We brought them to New York, and we brought them to LA, and their favourite part of the trip was Barna in Galway, and they absolutely loved it.
Do they think their Uncle Tommy's funny?
They love him. And I tell you something really funny. In New Zealand, on the school curriculum, they study Derry Girls. My daughter was doing it in school.
Wow.
Yeah. And so she put up her hand and was like, that's my uncle's in that. And nobody believed her. But they think he's brilliant. I mean, I think he's brilliant. So
yeah, he's a comic genius. Lovely guy too. Now, of course, your first book, which came out to such great acclaim, came from your own family story, really. And I spoke to Tommy, your brother, about your mom, her difficulties, I suppose, with alcohol addiction. In the end, she took her own life, which is so sad. And you felt, I think, Anne, that was a story you had to tell. You didn't set out to tell it. Remind me of that.
Yeah, so I started to write the book in 2017, and it was, that stage was 7 years after she died. And I really feel that with mum, I hadn't really grieved her death. So I was obviously living in New Zealand when she died, when I got the call. I was also 9 months pregnant, and I went into labour kind of a few hours afterwards. So gave birth to our third son.
Your Jack.
Our Jack, yeah. Mm. I couldn't come home for the funeral, obviously. Had to watch it on Zoom, you know. And so I felt very removed from what had happened. And I think, you know, there was also an emotional distance between myself and mum anyway growing up, because she had a lot of demons. Yeah, I didn't really process her death, didn't really grieve it. I mean, even though I came back shortly after she died, once my baby was old enough to travel. Anyway, in 2017, I decided, you know, I'd write the book, and I didn't really know what I was going to write about. And anyway, the first page, Joy turns up. She's a suicidal alcoholic. And I thought, oh, OK, well, let's just go with it. So took me 2 years to write it. And I think it became almost a form of therapy in a way. I know that sounds quite glib, but I think by the end, the book forced me to put myself in my mum's position. And I think by the end of it, I had a lot more empathy for her and a lot more love for her. So it was a good thing to have done.
Yeah. Was it cathartic? Did you feel it really was that?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Because it's, you know, I don't suffer happily from depression. I'm, you know, lucky so far I haven't. And it really forces you to go, what would it be like to believe that the world is better, would be better off without you? Because I think that's what she really thought.
And also you probably, as you say, feel much more sympathy for her now. Because was there a time when you might even have been angry with her?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, initially, and it sounds so selfish, but, you know, when she took her own life, which is, you know, when I was at 9 months pregnant, yeah, there was a part of me that went, you know, your timing kind of sucked, Mum. But of course, like, as I said, I now understand that she thought she was doing us all a favour. Yeah, so there was definitely anger there. And growing up, you know, I would have felt angry towards her. I would have thought, well, why can't you be more like other mums? Or, but it's funny, I guess now I know that there was a lot of people, a lot of my friends would have been going through the same thing, and maybe we didn't all talk about it.
She must have had lots of great gifts. And we will mention your dad as well in a minute because I'm conscious of him. But like, I've now met three Tiernans, Tommy, yourself and your sister Niamh here today. I haven't met the brother in New Zealand yet. But you're also talented and you're really gentle and lovely. So she must have had lots of goodness in her and talent.
She did. And she went to art school for a while and had to leave early. I think maybe because her dad died quite young. So she was very creative. She was a great singer. You'd find little drawings that she'd done all around the house. She'd draw on, you know, you'd pick up books and there was little drawings, or you'd pick up the newspaper and she would have done drawings. Yeah, I feel like there was so much wasted potential there. But that could have been maybe like a lot of women of her generation. Yeah.
Now tell me about your dad, because he's doing great, isn't he?
Dad's great. Dad is, he's a real character, loves to tell stories, loves his pints of Guinness down in the pub. Yeah, he's really good company and he's from a great family in Athlone. And yeah, he's great. He's, in many ways, I think Dad was my rock when I was growing up, because he was always so dependable. And I think if you've got one parent who's maybe not so dependable, and you've got one like him, then it's kind of save you.
Solid and steady.
Solid and steady, Miriam.
Now, listen, tell me about your new book. I loved it, The Good Mistress. Who are the three main protagonists?
Right. So the book follows three women, Juliet, Erica and Maeve, in the immediate aftermath of the death of the man who was married to Erica, was having an affair with Juliet and was a childhood friend of Maeve's.
Rory,
yes. And even though his death is the catalyst, I guess, for the recolliding of their lives, I think the real emotional heart of the book is the relationships between the women, and their relationships with their families. And it deals with a lot of midlife stuff, the challenges around that, ailing parents and teenage children and perimenopause and work stress and all the fun stuff. So, yeah, like I say, Rory is maybe the central figure at the beginning, but I hope that really the relationship and the connection between the women is really the central part of the book.
It absolutely is. And it's based in Ireland, in a town not that dissimilar to Navan.
Ballyboyne.
Where you grew up.
Yeah, it's funny. I was deciding, I was saying to my editor, should I just like call it Navan? Or, and they're like, well, if you call it Navan, then you're going to get people going, well, that's not really, that shop isn't there. Yeah. Or, so I have a couple of dear friends, actually, also from Ballyboyne, who came up with the name. That's so, great. Yeah, yeah.
And who are your early readers? Like, does Matt, your husband, read? Who do you trust? Who do you say, have a look at this?
Well, Niamh, my sister, obviously, great. She is, and Matt as well. Although, yeah, Matt, I feel, it just tells me everything is brilliant. So
we love him.
With the last days of joy, Tommy was one of the first readers of that as well. So, but again, it's funny when you ask people that you love and who love you, I don't think they'd ever tell you if it's rubbish, would they? They're, so I, you know, my editors will tell me if something's rubbish and needs to go. But I'm lucky to have those people who'll, yeah.
As we come to the end, you, it's great that you are now a writer because you wanted to be a writer. And I'm conscious there'll be people listening this morning who feel they have a book in them. So I think Tommy's advice to you in the first book was just write it. So yeah. What would your advice be?
Oh, well, look, absolutely. Look, I was 40 before I started writing. And by the time The Last Days of Joy was published, I was 49. So not a spring chicken. And I had worked in banking, which I was thoroughly unsuited for. And yeah, so it took me a long time to come around to do it. But yeah, Tommy just said, I thought I would have to have some kind of big plan and a book all. But he was just sit down and see what comes. And that's what happened. So, yeah, just if you want to do it, just do it.
You write really beautifully, though. Are you, have you started the next one yet?
I'm trying to find my way into book three. But yeah, I'm just playing around at the edges at the moment. Yeah.
Author Anne Tiernan on Sunday with Miriam. In recent years, saunas, mostly in coastal areas, have become hugely popular in Ireland. The practice of experiencing intense heat followed by intense cold is now a social or solo activity enjoyed by so many. But now a new book details how this is not a new phenomenon at all. It was practiced by our ancestors throughout Ireland for what was believed to be medical reasons for generations. And author Rosanna Cooney talks about this in her new book, Sweat House, The New and Ancient Irish Sauna Tradition. She spoke to Claire Byrne.
Can we just go back to 2022? Because I just, in your opening comments in the book, it was just you were going through an extraordinary time. Grief, pain. You didn't know what to do with yourself and you ended up going down this road of saunas. Talk to us about that a little.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, in October 2022, I was finding life incredibly challenging and was experiencing a lot of just grief. My mum was going through a really tough time with a new diagnosis and I suppose I just needed a way to feel something different other than kind of this overwhelming sense of grief that was kind of occupying every cell of my body. And yeah, so I was just kind of going through life. And then I heard about this sweat lodge down in Wicklow. I'd been to one years and years ago. And what I remembered was just that all I could feel was the heat, this intense heat in pitch black. And at this time when I needed to feel something else, I just thought that's what I need, to go somewhere where for a few hours I can not have to think. Mm-hmm. And I went to the sweat lodge, and it's really a simple structure, which is imagine kind of a tent covered with blankets and it's heated with stones that have been heated in a fire. And you're there with, you know, tens of people and kind of everyone squished in together. And what I found that day was not only that I got to feel this incredible, distracting, kind of obliterating heat, but actually all the kind of pain that I had been like trapping inside my own body was kind of brought to the surface. And it was like the heat kind of became this emotional poultice that could bring out what was inside. Mm-hmm. And I guess you have that action of sweating, bringing out to the from what's inside to the out. And it just made me think, oh, this is something that's actually really quite powerful.
So did that experience that you had in Wicklow, when it just sounds to me like you didn't know what to do with yourself and you found something that got you out of your head, did that then lead you to wanting to find out about the history and the story of sweating and saunas?
Exactly. I felt that this was something so deeply familiar and essential to my body and probably to many others. And I saw what was happening with kind of the sauna explosion around the country. And I just thought, this is something that's familiar. This is something that goes back much longer than the past kind of 6 or 10 years that we've had sauna in Ireland. And so I started really digging into it. And I went back, you know, prehistory, 3,000 years ago, when we have these incredible evidence of Bronze Age sweat lodges from Kilkenny to Meath and Cork. And you have these people who are living on our land 3,000 years ago, and they were building the similar sweat lodges gathering together with their communities, coming together by rivers to sweat at a time when, you know, the mental health benefits, the physical benefits weren't known, but it was still something they felt necessary to do.
I expect this is a real surprise to many people who would have thought that maybe in the Celtic Tiger years, you know, the fancy gym brought in the sauna, copying the Austrians or the Finns, the Northern Europeans. But no, this goes back for generations and generations. And you describe in a brilliant way these old saunas built from rock, from stone, and often turf was used, wasn't it, to build the fire inside.
Exactly. So kind of coming up towards, you know, pre-famine, 17th, 18th, 19th century, we had these stone domes that are still scattered around the country. You can still go visit them. You can crawl inside them exactly where people would have crawled in themselves, you know, a few hundred years ago or as recently as 100 years ago to sit and be naked and sweat. And these are places that, again, people pursued for maybe arthritis or rheumatism, but possibly also for something else, you know, to be have that kind of transported feeling to go somewhere else with their minds and their bodies. And exactly, this isn't, you know, sauna is this incredible tradition that is spread across the world now, but it's also one that has very deep roots in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And even though what we're familiar with now is sort of like an imported kind of Finnish tradition, the actual essence of it is something that's, you know, deeply familiar to us.
And you got to visit some of those sites of the ancient saunas and you got to go inside. What was it like? Is it very claustrophobic in some of them?
It's not claustrophobic. You have to really bear crawl and kind of wriggle and shimmy in because they're quite low to the ground, the entrance. But once you get past that, you're in this like really enclosed, dark, very dark, but like safe space. And I found that actually noise doesn't really travel from inside out. So you feel quite safe and enclosed. That the best word is enclosed rather than claustrophobic. And I found like quite magical actually, because you're sitting there in these stone places and you can see on the stones that the walls have been charred black from previous fires or scorched red. And just seeing that physical evidence of fires that were lit there by people from the area that you're like in right now, that and all these places, you know, what's fascinating to me is that they were done for communities by communities. They weren't, you know, they weren't elite, they weren't expensive, they were free for communities to use. People did them, lit fires and created these spaces for their neighbors, for their partners, for their friends, mm-hmm. because there's this sense that, you know, they didn't want people to be unwell. They wanted everyone in the group to be well.
Yeah, and it was seen as a route to better health, wasn't it? Often in times when medical care was very limited. And I noticed as well that there were so many of them in places that had limited healthcare. So not so many of these sweat houses near cities, for example.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because we don't have evidence of them in Dublin, let's say. There is one in Wicklow, but the majority of them at the moment that we know of are in Leitrim. There's a strong distribution there. But exactly that, like, you know, paracetamol wasn't synthesized yet. Vitamins and hormones hadn't been discovered. There was no way to examine the internal body. So how did people kind of look for cures? How do they find ways to feel better? And heat was this kind of, you know, there's ancient knowledge that does bring a healing. And so these places were people's apothecary when they didn't have access to a doctor or maybe even money for one. And they went there in search of that. And often it does seem that they found them, because we have great accounts of people kind of reporting that they could cure almost anything using them. I don't know the veracity of that, but yeah. But there is amazing stories of healers as well. These healers and women in Ireland who use sweat houses as part of their repertoire. So people in Donegal who had very specialised knowledge of herbs to use, of a specific way of using the sweat house over a number of hours and days that could cure people, and people really trusted these healers and trusted the method.
So the logistics then of setting the fire, so the fire would be lit, and then how would they damp down the fire and make it safe for somebody to go in there?
Yeah, exactly. So how we understand it now is the fire, usually with turf, would be lit inside this chamber, let's call it. And they're quite small spaces, like it'd be hard to stand up in one. And then the fire would burn for a few hours. And then once the stone walls had absorbed enough heat and energy of the fire, the turf would be scraped out. And then usually green rushes would be strewn on the ground because people were going to have to crawl in, and obviously the ground would be scorched. So then people could crawl in on the green rushes and sit there. Maybe they'd bring in turf with them or another rock, sit and be, usually they were naked. And then the entrance to the sweat house would be plugged, and at that point that's when they become completely dark, and that's when the temperature would actually shoot up. And what's really interesting is that we know from modern archaeological interrogations of the sweat house that the temperature in there for people using them was actually 90 degrees. It could reach 90 degrees, which when I, because I was reading accounts of people saying, oh, you know, it was blisteringly hot, and you're kind of thinking, well, these people maybe have never left Ireland, you know, they wouldn't have been in any other kind of sauna or had this huge heat exposure. So I was thinking, how hot could they really have been? But then you got these amazing archaeological tests that show, no, it was 90 degrees, which is something our modern saunas are at.
Yeah, and I mean, some of the experiences that you have had, the heat is really intense, but then you go back for more all of the time. Can you explain to people why that is?
Yeah, I think there does become, it does become addictive in like a slightly positive way, because it's something that, for me, I get this quite immediate like endorphin rush afterwards. And it's almost, for me, I find like a reset. If I'm having a hard day, if I'm, something's gone wrong, anything, I know I can go there. And it's like this reset button is just pushed. I get a second chance at my day. And I don't know if in a way that's because you're pushing your body to do something that's a little bit uncomfortable, a little bit hard, and yet you're managing and you're surviving and you're getting through it. And that's just kind of building you for what comes next. And that's quite valuable sometimes, I think, to go through things that are uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Not everything needs to be easy. And then you have the cold plunge as well, which again, you're kind of bringing your body through this extremes of heat and cold, and then bringing it into this beautiful resting period where everything can actually come back to an equilibrium. So there's that kind of mental aspect, mental health aspect that comes with it. But another really, truly brilliant thing, which I find, think a lot of people find, is that you just sleep so well afterwards. Sleep so restorative for us. And I think we know the benefits, but often a brilliant night's sleep after a sauna just sets you up again for the next day.
And I should mention as well, you did travel throughout Europe. You went to the Nordic countries, to Finland, to Estonia. Is the story similar there? Does it compare well to the Irish story of sauna?
Yeah, it's super interesting because in these countries that I went to, I really wanted to see what it looked like to have an unbroken tradition of sauna. Whereas in Ireland, we have this really deep, rich, amazing history, but it has been broken over time. So I wanted to go places where you have, you know, centuries of tradition layered and built on top of each other to see what that looks like now. So let's say in Finland, I found that, you know, there's a lot of healers or, you know, people working in the sauna that use the steam that's created there almost as a method of kind of breathing new life into people. Or Estonia, you have people who believe that your ancestors and every future generation live in the sauna. And in Latvia and Lithuania, where the sauna has kind of survived decades of political oppression.
Rosanna Cooney, author of Sweat House, The New and Ancient Irish Sauna Tradition, on Today with Claire Byrne. And that's all we have time for on this edition of Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.